Ari Wallach has taught at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, founded and still leads Long Path Labs. He's a futurist and social systems strategist focused on sustainable, thriving humanity and the planet in the coming decades and centuries. And a great person to start this conversation, encouraging all of us to dread not as we face the future with less fear and more hope. So, Ari, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, when you and I first met over a decade ago, Long Path was just getting started. You were just giving birth to Long Path, and now it's becoming a worldwide movement. So I know you could speak for days about Long Path, but just briefly bring our listeners up to date on what Long Path means.
So first of all, thank you for having me, and it's great to be here with you. So the book, Long Path, Becoming the Great Ancestors, Our Future Needs, was written to kind of help people think about both the moment that we're in, but more specifically, how to take Long Path, which is really kind of an applied mindset. It's a way of thinking about the world today and our collective role in it, as well as our individual role and our individual agency in the world today, and how we go about with that mindset, creating the futures that we want, as opposed to this idea that the future is just a kind of a noun that is out there that washes over us. So it's very much about the future as a verb that people have and hold within them in terms of what they do day in and day out, as opposed to the future being this thing that will kind of happen and is already predefined and predestined to happen.
So when we were first experiencing our friendship, I remember we used that biblical phrase, reading the signs of the times, to understand what time we were living in. And in your book, you talk about the challenging times we're living in as you use the word intertidal. So tell us a little bit more about this intertidal time.
Yeah, of course.
As it relates to the time that we're going through now.
So the intertidal as a kind of, in terms of marine ecosystems, where I'm taking the metaphor from, is that place that many of us who have visited the ocean know really well. It's a place of tide pools. It's a place where sometimes it's covered by water and sometimes it's not. And that's kind of where we are right now. We're in this kind of interregnum or in-between space. And specifically, I'm placing our intertidal within a kind of larger historical arc. And in some ways, it's very much through a Western lens, but I think it's actually global in many ways. And so the argument that I'm making is that this intertidal moment is happening because we are on the tail end of probably the past 300 to 400 years of a certain kind of mindset that sees the world through the kind of scientific breaking things down that are very complex into their individual parts to better understand them moment. Now, as a scientist, I love what the Renaissance and the Enlightenment has given us. But what has happened is we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, because this scientific way of looking at the world, overly kind of hyper-rational, if you will, has led to a kind of disenchantment with the kind of spiritual and awe-based nature of reality. And so what ends up happening is, even though we are far into this kind of technological moment, we all know that the kind of narratives and the stories about how the world is supposed to work and is going to work, what we call the official future, is breaking down. And this intertidal moment is where we see those things kind of breaking down and we feel it, but we don't know what is yet going to replace it. So in that in-between, we find ourselves in this intertidal moment.
So it's sort of a space of, the mystics would say, a space of unknowing. And that can be a very creative, you even say it's a juicy and creative space.
It's a juicy,
even if it feels anxiety producing.
The animals that exist in the intertidal zone are some of the most fascinating ones in nature, because they figure out how to kind of evolve and survive and flourish in these types of moments. Now, let's be clear, the intertidal is not a place that we want to be in for a long time, because it's very difficult. And there eventually will be a new official future, because for Homo sapiens, living without a kind of an official future or a narrative or a set of narratives is cognitively taxing. So eventually something will come in to replace it. The question is, what is that going to be? And in this moment, it could kind of go, it could kind of go either way. And to go back with what you just said, look, I'm, as you know, I'm obviously influenced by a lot of wisdom traditions, mine being Judaism. And so I think of the Exodus story and the kind of 40 years of wandering in the desert as kind of an intertidal between what was and what will be. And one of the things I speak about in the book, which hopefully we'll get into, is this idea of telos or ultimate aim. And so what I think is as important in terms of recognizing that we're in an intertidal moment is recognizing what tends to pull us out of it, and having that ultimate aim or larger purpose is going to be key for us, just like it was for those who were wandering the desert for 40 years.
I want to pick up on your personal story in terms of being a Jew whose family was deeply affected by the Holocaust, and as the creator of Long Path, how do you understand this moment when there's such an assault against religious freedom and other freedoms, this rise of white Christian nationalism, increased violence related to that, you know, the erosion of our democratic aspirations. How do you understand that from a Long Path perspective?
Well, so,
and from your own, you know, life situation as a Jew in this country.
And as the son of someone who survived the Holocaust, right? So it's rare for someone my age, I'm a young 47-year-old, who is a first-generation Holocaust survivor, because my dad had me when he was 50. So usually these are stories that you are told about the Holocaust from your grandparents. That wasn't the case for me. I was told these stories as a 5 and 7-year-old by my dad who lived it. And the reality was, when we would talk about what happened in World War II, he grew up in a small village in Poland and ended up fighting with the Jewish resistance for several years. And it was a Nazi hunter after the war. And one of the things that he always said was, and it greatly influenced his Long Path, was he goes, look, the Holocaust in World War II didn't start in the, you know, early 1940s or 1939, like everyone said. It started in the 1920s. It started with the Treaty of Versailles. Mm-hmm. It started in the past. And there was a whole host of issues around, you know, the Germans and shame and guilt and World War I. And this is definitely not to let anyone off the hook. I will be the last one to do that when it comes to folks who perpetuated the atrocities of World War II, and specifically the Holocaust. But what it does is, and the way it influenced Long Path, is when I think about how we make these futures that we want, we can't start from today. We have to actually go into the past to recognize what created the kind of systemic and foundational ontologies, ways of being that led to these horrific things happening. So when I look at the rise of, you know, white Christian nationalism and all these issues that are happening right now, I don't see them through the lens of, or even think about them temporally as 2022. I think of some of these going back to the 14, 1500s and kind of what happened when the church, and I mean that with a capital T and a capital C as a bureaucratic larger institution, lost power and then the reverberations of that. And I see that through line in the same way that being raised in a home saw the through line of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism as not just, yes, in the 1920s and 30s, as I said, but also in many ways going back centuries. And so the moment that we're in, if we want to think about how we deal with these issues that we are facing and those who are wishing to perpetuate harm and violence, I'm not advocating that we let them off the hook because they were born into this. What I'm saying is that for us to think about how we're going to combat and move past this moment, we have to recognize where all folks are coming from, what intergenerational stories, trauma, ways of being are being embodied by them right now, if we are going to solve this at a systemic level. At an acute level, there are things that we have to do right now to ensure safety for all. But if we want to get at the underlying issues, what Long Path shows, and through the work that we've done at Long Path Labs, is we have to meet people where they are, and where they are in many ways is embedded in deep historical ways of being that those of us, and I'll be totally honest, those of us, I'll speak for myself, on the left of the political spectrum, don't often take into account.
I think it's a very hard leap for many of us to make in this divided country. Let's bring it down to the practical level, because you do in the book, you talk a lot about practical things, the things that you can do every day. You use, and I love this, the trim tab example of how a tiny little mechanism on a ship can turn the ship. So bring it down to, you know, the lives of everyday people, to your life. I mean, you say that long path is something that you use every day. So help us figure out how we move from short-termism, because we like to think in the short term, to reframing towards a more of a long path way of being.
Sure. So I talked about the title of the book. The bottom of the book does an antidote for short-termism. So look, short-termism in and of itself isn't inherently a terrible thing. If Ari and Catherine are walking 15,000 years ago and a very large animal jumps out of, you know, from a tree at us, we need to enact short-term thinking, right? We need to actually take acute action, kind of what I was getting at before. The problem happens when short-termism becomes the all-pervasive way of acting and being in the world, which I argue in the book comes from two things. One, obviously, kind of technology and capitalism and the way we kind of view ourselves in an overly quantified world, which is kind of part of, again, this kind of enlightenment, rational way of thinking, kind of this big data approach to living, if you will. The other is when we're in this kind of intertidal moment, what is going to happen at literally at the amygdala level is when we are faced with any issue whatsoever, we are going to be hyper reactive to it instead of pausing and thinking about the long-term reverberations and ramifications, because we're at this kind of heightened cortisol level, right? Because we talked a little about when we have no official future, we're kind of like always on, we're always in the cortisol mode. So that being said, how we bring this back to, how to bring long path into like our day-to-day way of being is this, part of it is this trim tab approach. And so we're just so your listeners know, Buckminster Fuller, who is a very famous kind of architect and futurist, passed away several decades ago. But one of the things that he, actually, on his tombstone, where it says his name and his, you know, date of birth and death, it says above that, it says, call me trim tab. Well, why did he put that? Because the trim tab is something, is a thing that he came up with because he was asked in the 1940s by the U.S. Navy to help them think about how these cargo ships were getting so large that the rudders that were needed to steer them were going to, you know, becoming cumbersome. They were 10, 15 feet long. It just didn't make sense. They couldn't figure out the hydraulics to turn these massive rudders. So he came up with this idea called the trim tab, which was literally like a 4 to 5 inch piece of steel that went at the very end of the rudder. And what he realized is if you just turned that small piece of steel at the end, that small trim tab, if you pointed it against the force of oncoming water, it itself would create a kind of positive feedback loop that would throw the rudder the rest of the way. So literally by kind of going into the pressure, you would make big dramatic changes and you could steer these giant ships with a small 4 inch piece of steel. So why he put on his tombstone, call me trim tab, was his belief that every one of us in our moment to moment actions, especially at scale, can create long-term changes in any system. So what does this mean at the practical level? How do you live long path at the practical level? So, you know, some people who have picked up the book and are reading, they're like, oh, I thought there's going to be a, you know, a book about scenarios and big futures planning, but it's really a book about how to live your life in a way that is conscious and actually thinking about what you do or don't do and the ramifications of that in the short term and the long term. So an example of that, there's a lot of exercises in the book, is actually, mm-hmm. and this will sound very simple, but I'm recontextualizing it, is between any action and a reaction is a moment, right? In the brain, that's a synaptic juncture. And that can happen, more often than not, happens in milliseconds. But what long path asks us to do, and at first it's very awkward, and then it becomes something that you just kind of automatically do, is to take that pause and think about whatever it is however you're about to react to whatever it is. So in the book, I very early talk about getting a message from my daughter's school that she missed a Spanish assignment by 5 seconds ago and my kind of visceral reaction to that, or something much bigger, let's say political, is thinking how I act in the next moment, how I react, what I do next, how is that going to both play out in the moment vis-a-vis the situation that I'm in with those around me, And more specifically, how will that model a way of being, a certain set of behaviors and reactions, not only for them, be it a loved one or a colleague, or even someone on the other side of the, you know, the protest line, how is that going to reverberate, not just with myself and with them, but for generations to come? Because what we know, and this is obviously, you know, based on science from Stanford and Northeastern, is that emotions are contagious. Behaviors are contagious. Sometimes it cannot feel that way, especially when you're doing this with someone who is screaming and yelling at you. But I think Gandhi and MLK Jr. have given us great examples of what this looks like when you are living in a trim tab sense of being. It actually does and will change the future. Now, I know this can sound kind of new age and woo-woo, but the fact of the matter is when we look at this in labs, when we look at this in situations where we've actually been able to control for groups of people and we have, you know, and we can isolate different variables, it's actually true. How you react in that moment, if you do it with an eye towards a longer term future, actually will change that future.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And, you know, I think that, I mean, the practical thing that you said here is taking that pause, which is very hard to do, whether we're talking about relating to a child or a partner or a political opponent, right? And I hadn't planned it, but all of you on this show today are parents of young children. So talk a little bit about, because this is not just a theoretical, Long Path is not just theoretical, it's actually personal. And you're obviously, you know, building a future with your own children in mind. So talk about that.
Yeah, look, it's funny because different people are reviewing the book, and I just got off a call with someone who's in a Washington DC policy think tank who does like nuclear proliferation. And he's like, wow, you know, I read your book trying to think about how this would impact the work we do in nuclear proliferation on the world. He goes, but I have to be honest with you, the examples that you kept giving me, I was thinking about nuclear proliferation and the policy work. Then he said, but as a parent, as a father, I kept thinking of this as this became a parenting book, because it kind of started kind of replacing the agency that one has as a parent. And by the way, it doesn't have to be your own children, right? This way of being is
right.
We're all kind of, we should all see ourselves as kind of children and being alloparenting, parented by one another in a collective communal sense. It changes the way you do what you do. Another example in the book is, and I've said this in a couple of different places, is like, you know, you go, look, the short pathway of dealing with a screaming child at a dinner table at a restaurant is to put a screen in front of them. The long path is to engage them in a conversation in a way of being that self-regulates emotions and actually can lead to kind of more interesting conversations and ways of being. You can't always do that, because maybe the kid's really hungry and you waited too long to eat. So that's why Long Path isn't just about the future. It's also about what we call transgenerational empathy, which is thinking about the past. So part of it is ensuring that as you move into this kind of, you're going out to eat, like, where is your kid's blood sugar at? Like, are you taking care of your future self and your future children in such a way that you can avoid some of these issues and confrontations in the first place? It's extremely difficult to do, to actually think about your future self and future others. But the exercises in the book are meant to kind of get you into that way of thinking and being, not just at a cognitive layer, but obviously at an emotional layer. You know, one of the things I talk about is what we have in our home is we have, like many people have, photos of their family up, but we have photos of my parents and my wife's parents up, and, you know, the generation that came before us. We have family photos, but we also have this blank photo frame that kind of trips people out sometimes. It's literally just a frame with a white background. So what that represents to us as a family, as an individual, is generations to come. And it might sound kind of silly, but I walk by this, you know, two or three times a day, especially because, you know, like a lot of us, we spend more time at home. And it just gives me that half a second to remember, like, oh yeah, it's not just about me. There are others to come. And how am I influencing them? So it's not just how am I being a better self to future Ari, it's how am I, what and how am I doing in a way that is being better for future generations, specifically my future grandchildren. Look, my kids are teenagers. There's no grandchildren coming anytime soon. But the fact of the matter is how we raise, how we interact with our children and those around us of the next generation is going to greatly impact how they are with future generations. And so when we start to think about it through that way, that kind of lens, it starts to change how we interact and behave and model behaviors for our children and those around us of the next generation.
One of the other examples that you give is leaving a chair empty at, or having an empty chair at the table to represent future generations to come. So I know it's Elijah, but
Elijah. Well, no one else knows it's Elijah. So it comes from Elijah. It comes from, and I know this is not always the best person to example. So one of the things that Jeff Bezos started doing at Amazon is he would leave an empty chair for the customer. And so whenever they got to a point in a conversation, in a big meeting, he would point to the empty chair and he said, well, what does the customer want? And so I kind of took from that the empty chair, but it was less about, you know, the quote unquote customer, which sometimes can lead to very short-term decision-making, even on, you know, on many levels. And that empty chair is for the future or future generations. So in folks that I work with, be it the UN or US State Department or corporations, I'll say, look, when we're having big meetings, leave that chair empty. It's for future customers. It's for future generations. It could even be for the future executive director or CEO, which, as you know, no leader ever wants to think about the leader that comes after them. But if they really want to make those wise decisions, the ones that actually can impact the far future for the better, they have to think about even who is going to replace them at some point.
Of course.
I mean, we do that with who's going to replace me. In impacting next generations is going to be my children, then my grandchildren. So that's easy to do because it deals with my own death and I can foresee that. It's very difficult for leaders to do that, but that's a lot of the work that we do and kind of coaching and working with them is saying, listen, at some point you won't be in that chair. Someone else will be. How are you ensuring you are making decisions and you are passing the baton? I was a track runner in high school and I ran the 4x100 relay. And so whereas we learned to run as fast as we could, the reality is what won or lost those races was how smoothly we passed the baton on to the next runner. And so the empty chair can be for those leaders to come, and the decisions that we make are how smooth that baton will pass.
One of the anxieties and fears that people have right now, and you mentioned it earlier, is the fear of relating to people with whom you disagree. I mean, we're a country that's deeply, deeply divided. Say a little bit, tell us a little bit about how a long path process can help us relate to people from whom we're so estranged, whether it's in our own families or in our communities, people on different sides of the political spectrum. From where we sit.
So it's interesting. I talked about this earlier about, we were talking about the kind of the Exodus story and this kind of intertidal and being, you know, wandering in the desert. And it's my contention that what pulled us through that moment was this idea of this kind of this land of milk and honey. This ultimate aim was to get to a place that was the opposite of the desert, but was overflowing with abundance. And what I have found, and you know, let me pivot for a second. I was the head of conflict resolution at UC Berkeley for the Student Co-op Association. So what that meant was I carried a pager around in the late 90s, and I'd get a page from these house managers saying, we have a conflict in the house. These two roommates or these folks are fighting. Can you come resolve it? And I would go and I would kind of work on not quote unquote resolving the conflict, but transforming the conflict transformation. And what I found was the best way to kind of transform the conflict wasn't to start with where we are right now, but to actually start at the end and work backwards, what we call backcasting in the futuring world. And so what that meant was finding and getting to a place where we could talk about what that land of milk and honey looked like for all interested parties, and then work backwards to how we got there. Because what I found was that even though this is counterintuitive, the future itself is an uncontested space for a brief moment. When you ask people from a values-based and morals-based, what is it that they want the world to look and feel like after they are gone? And that's a whole other conversation about lifespan bias and death awareness. So what we found is when we talk about the land of milk and honey, or what I call in the book Telos, ultimate aim, is by starting there and saying, well, what's the most important to you? What is the world you want your children and your grandchildren to live in? We actually start to find a lot of commonality. We actually start to find we all want some of the same things for our children and our grandchildren. There, it may not be a perfect overlap, but it's more overlappy than where we are as adults with our own baggage and our own traumas and our own ways of seeing the world. And so the key, what LongPath helps us do is by starting at the end and moving backwards, we can start to engage in those conversations. And so, you know, we, Catherine, when we were first kind of working together, we were working on some marriage equality and some other work and around kind of like, how do you have those very difficult conversations around the Thanksgiving table? Here's the thing. Don't start with today. Don't start about, you know, don't talk about the midterms. Don't talk about race and class as it is today. Talk about what is it you would like to see the world to come actually look like? What is that? Mm-hmm. And when I say the messianic moment, I don't mean the Messiah, but for some they do. For me, the messianic moment is this ongoing verb and way of being in the world where we are kind of where what we call protopian, which isn't perfect, but it's a world better than today. So having those conversations, start with what you want it to look like, can become a way of engaging folks in that conversation. Now, look, the fact of the matter is, I don't want to be Pollyannish. Some folks just don't want to engage in that. And it is what it is. But what I would advocate for your listeners to do is start with the end in mind. And if you do that with the folks that are the most adversarial, if they're open to doing it, and by the way, people are always talking to, people are more often than not very open to talking about what they want for their grandkids and their kids. And sometimes that's actually just a projection of what they want for themselves, but they don't feel safe enough to have that conversation. But if you start far out there and find the commonality, then you say, well, then what has to be true for that to happen? Well, what has to be true for that to happen? That's classic backcasting work that I've been doing for 20 years, but in a more kind of democratic governance in the civil society space, we find that we're able to start finding ways that people will actually communicate across seemingly large chasms because they are now speaking towards a world that they want to see manifest as opposed to the one that they don't want to see manifest. And from there, you can start doing the work that needs to happen.
Ari, we've just scratched the surface, but it is so great to be with you again and to hear how LongPath is progressing. Thanks for offering us a framework and a way to work towards a future of promise and hope on State of Belief Radio. Futurist Ari Wallach is a social system strategist, founder and CEO of LongPath Labs, and author of LongPath, Becoming the Great Ancestors Our Future Needs. Ari's TED Talk on LongPath has been viewed over 2.5 million times and translated into 19 languages. Ari, thank you.
My pleasure.